Hi, my name's Tori and I wish I knew more about blood products.
Hi, my name's Letitia. I wish I knew more about taking care of myself when starting shift work.
Hi, my name is Lydia. I wish I would know more about how to work as in a team and solve conflict.
Hello, welcome to Five Things, the nursing podcast from the Royal Brisbane and Women's Hospital. My name is Liz Crowe.
I'm Jesse Spur, and this is a podcast by, for, and with the amazing nurses and health professionals in our corner of the world. We hope to connect with a global community as we move from surviving to thriving. Welcome to Five Things.
Hello, my name is Liz Crowe.
And I'm Jesse Spur.
Welcome to another episode of Five Things. And today we're welcoming my friend, Charlene Pike, who's coming to talk to us about dementia. And Charlene is the Acting Clinical Nurse Consultant at the Dementia Outreach Service at Metro South Health. Welcome, Charlene.
Thank you very much.
So exciting to have you. We would love, if you can remember it, to tell us your origin story.
Back those years, yes. Okay, so I didn't actually ever aspire to be a nurse. I had a year overseas as an exchange student in Austria after school, which I absolutely loved. And then I came back to Australia and I was tripping around with one of my host sisters. And after 6 months, my mother said, "You need to get a job."
In that voice.
In that voice. And she said, "There's a November intake at PA. How about becoming a nurse?" And that's pretty much how it all started. So, yeah, did my training. Worked as a nurse for probably 15 years, then took 10 years out working in an office, and then came back to nursing when my kids were a lot older, and did a re-entry program, worked as an AIN, which was a big eye-opener, and then just sort of fell into the dementia space and have absolutely loved it ever since. So, yeah.
What drew you to that area?
Well, I thought actually coming back as an older person and not having worked in nursing for 10 years, I thought, oh, aged care will be easy, you know. This is a sort of a safe space and it's not sort of high tech like the hospital. Boy, was I wrong. Because yeah. You can be, you know, as a registered nurse, especially in the private sector, you can be thrown in and be in charge of, you know, 120 residents on a shift and, yeah.
With one nurse.
With one registered nurse. And, yes, it can be very, very daunting, but luckily sink or swim.
Just for the visual, Liz's jaw nearly hit the table there.
I'm like, one registered nurse to 120 elderly people in a residential facility.
Yep.
That's terrifying.
Yeah, they do have, obviously, there's enrolled nurses and assistant nurses, but, yeah, sometimes it's one RN who's, you know, the buck stops with them. So it can be very daunting.
I'm super excited for this episode just to present the positives of a career in that space as well, because we haven't really got there yet on this.
Yeah. All right, so let's get straight into it. Yep. So your number one is, what is dementia?
So I guess there's a lot of confusion around dementia, and even years ago it was sort of termed senile dementia, and there's been lots of different things people get confused about, Alzheimer's disease, you know, and all the different types. So basically dementia is like an umbrella term, and it covers over 100 different diseases, probably more, that describe how the brain is affected. So it's a progressive decline and the person's ability to remember, think and learn is impaired. So all of the abilities that our brain, the functions that our brain has, so it affects everything like judgment, orientation, memory, your emotions and how you think. Alzheimer's disease is just one type of dementia, and it's probably the most common. Now we are seeing people with what they call a mixed dementia. So they might have a bit of a vascular profile as well as Alzheimer's. We see people with Parkinson's can develop dementia, and that can be Parkinson's dementia, or there can be frontotemporal dementia, Lewy body dementia. There's quite a few different sorts. So it's just a sort of a blanket term for all of those diseases.
And am I right in sort of the assumption that there's a mix of both radiological changes, so like there's the physical changes visible that can help, that are part of the definition of what type of dementia it is, and also then the clinical profile and behavioural or cognitive function profiles?
Definitely, yeah, yeah. And I think because Alzheimer's disease is probably the only one that's really definitive on autopsy, we do make a lot of educated guesses, I guess, around, and that's why the diagnosis part is so important, because there's a lot of components that make up a diagnosis.
Okay, I think that probably leads us perfectly into number two, which is what are the signs and symptoms, and like how do you get a diagnosis? Because I've heard, you know, I've only had one part, like given that it's just a collection of kind of symptoms, how do you even get a diagnosis? Yeah. So what are the signs, first of all?
Yeah, so it can be a bit tricky, and lots of adults do experience, and we've just chatted also about our own situation, you know, forgetting things. So I guess memory loss is probably the big one. It sort of builds. So, you know, you might have some issues around maybe forgetting where your keys are. We've all done that. Forgetting where the car is in the car park. We've all done that. But it's building on all of those things. So you might have problems with problem solving. You might have problems with completing everyday tasks. So you might have some confusion about time or place. Trouble understanding, you know, depth perception. So if you think about the way the brain operates, and because it operates everything in our body, when there's damage in the brain, it can affect so many different things. So it's really about judgment can be affected. It's about trying to put all of those signs and symptoms together and figuring out if there is a problem, or if it's just normal aging, or if it's something else, and we'll talk about that in a minute when we talk about sort of the diagnostics.
So it is tricky, right? Because as you age, your memory does naturally decline.
Yeah.
And so we all can worry, you know, I just said off air, you know, like I'm finding as I get older, my recall for things, I think, I know this, I know this person's name. But I guess the difference you just said to us off air is I do eventually remember and then I'm completely able to finish the task engage with the human or whatever. And that's the difference, isn't it?
I guess
if you've got dementia, there's a decline in that and the recall doesn't come back.
That's correct, yes. And so that if you sit with something, you know, like you might be having a discussion with your family, you know, what's the name of that actor who's in that movie, et cetera, et cetera. If you, now we've got search engines, there's no unanswered questions. So often we're looking things up and we're finding those answers. But if you sit with yourself and just give yourself time and switch off and don't think about that, your brain will find it in the filing system. So if you can come to that point where you are finding that information, then that's not a problem. If you get to the point where you can never remember it, there are so many things you're forgetting, then yeah, you definitely need to go and see your GP.
And am I right then in saying that it's not just my ability to recall, it's my ability to problem solve that? So we're playing a game, someone's trying to remember an actor's name, I know to pull out my phone, I can operate my telephone. But if someone is also struggling to problem solve how to find the answer, that's another sign
or
symptom.
That's exactly right, yeah. So if you've got somebody that you're as part of one of my roles, I do a lot of cognitive assessments on people. So if I say, what's the date? And I know that they're sitting in front of a calendar and they can't look at that and figure it out what the date is, then there's a problem. You or I would just go, oh, can I cheat? Can I look at the calendar? You know what I mean? Because that's what we do. We problem solve. Yeah. So that's a very good point. Yep.
It's such an interesting area of disease because of that fact that you've also got the, I guess, for want of a better term, the contamination of intelligence and cognitive function at the baseline for people. So I've really observed patients in the past where they've been incredibly intelligent, high processing, high problem solving people, and they appear to have this really sudden decline. In hindsight, you look at all of these coping mechanisms and strategies that they've kept in place,
definitely
until they can't anymore.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And then we call that cognitive reserve. Yeah. So if you've got more cognitive reserve than somebody else, then not always you might be able to maintain your cognition a little bit better than somebody who perhaps left school at grade 9, has worked in jobs where they didn't really have to think very much, or they didn't, you know, that sort of thing. Those people might be quicker to lose their cognitive reserve.
And I think that's kind of misinterpreted sometimes by all this stuff of saying, oh, if you do crosswords and stuff, it prevents dementia.
No.
But it you're building the cognitive reserve,
aren't
you? It's essentially doing weights training for your brain.
Exactly, yeah. It's that whole if you don't use it, you lose it thing. And whilst it's there is very small amount of evidence that it actually enhances your cognitive ability, but it's more about the fact that if you are continuing to use your brain, you are less likely to, you know, increase your cognitive decline.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we've talked about some of the signs and symptoms. Like, how does someone get a diagnosis?
Okay. So it can be quite a lengthy process, and it depends on a lot of things. So people who are younger, for example, who notice that they might be having some issues with their memory or executive functioning, they'll go to a doctor, and often that's really, you know, they might say, let's investigate your stress or your anxiety or depression, because they don't present as somebody. We expect people who are going to develop dementia are in their sort of 80s. And so it's sometimes very difficult to get a diagnosis, especially for younger people. There are things like hormonal changes and, like I said, depression and anxiety, stress. All of these things can actually impede your ability to remember things and to think, to problem solve. So we have to – it's kind of like an idea where we're taking out all of the other things that it might not be and so we can figure out what is actually happening.
So we do this with a lot of neurological disorders, is sort of start with the organic causes and sort of try and exclude them. So it's that kind of stepwise, I'm hearing it, sort of that stepwise exclusion of organic causes.
Yes.
Then move on to looking at other possible presenting illnesses in the psychiatric or I guess functional neurological illnesses, and then looking at radiological investigations and then piling all of those things together with a detailed behavioural and memory assessment.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I guess most older adults, if they're engaging with their GP, if they're going and seeing them regularly, the GP would be aware of changes that are happening, even though they don't see them regularly. I mean, every day they would have an idea that there is some decline. So the GP is really the first person who would identify sort of issues with memory. And they, as part of various assessments that they would do, they would probably do some mini mental state examination to get a baseline, and then go from there. So if they felt that the person was declining, then they would probably send them to a geriatrician who would then do more of a comprehensive. They'd probably send them off for a CT, maybe a PET scan, maybe an MRI, depending on what they're seeing. And then they'd have more extensive cognitive screening, and then come up with perhaps a working diagnosis of. Often people are diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment first. And you can have mild cognitive impairment, but it doesn't progress. So it's not the end of the world if you do have a mild cognitive impairment. But then if they get you back in 6 months, 12 months, then they probably would say, you know, it looks like there might be a diagnosis of dementia, and then they could perhaps be clearer on what type. At the end of the day, it doesn't really matter what type of dementia. It's good to know, because if you have Alzheimer's disease, for example, you might benefit from some medication, so some cholinesterase inhibitors, which, you know, affect the neurotransmitters in the brain. So it could be, you know, that it slows the progression of the dementia down. Nothing, there is no cure. There is no real treatment in as such. So it's really more system management. But some people who develop Alzheimer's disease and start on some medication, They can maintain their cognition for a little bit longer. So it's more about sort of keeping them at the level that they're at.
Mm.
The other types of dementia, there's really no treatment per se, but it's really about managing those symptoms that they might experience.
So can I ask, Charlene, would you say dementia is a terminal
disease? Yes, it is. Yes, it is. So if people are diagnosed with dementia, it will eventually, that's what they'll die of. Years ago, they used to put things like aspiration pneumonia or, you know, if people stop eating, that sort of thing. But now it's classed as something that is terminal, yes.
So they die of complications of that disease.
Correct, yeah. Yes. But it can be very long too. Somebody can have it, you know, for example, a frontotemporal dementia, people progress quite quickly. But somebody who has Alzheimer's disease, and the other thing too that we didn't really talk about is it can be developing in the brain a long time before we have any signs and symptoms. So that's why treatment is so difficult, because somebody might present as having problems with their memory, for example, but then if they went back and had a look at, if they could go back in time and look at CTs or MRIs, there's probably damage to the brain 20 years before we're showing any signs and symptoms.
Yeah.
So okay.
So it's as you've both kind of suggested, it's kind of like putting all the pieces together.
Yeah,
and then if you get enough of those kind of specific signs and symptoms, you get this umbrella term of dementia.
Mm-hmm.
And then for some people that becomes more of a specific diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
But
right.
On the whole, people will still be treated the same.
Pretty much, yeah. And it's really about trying to, you know, link people with services and with, you know, support groups. And Alzheimer's Australia and Dementia Australia have huge resources for counselling and for, you know, getting people sort of educated in the beginning and giving you a bit of an idea about what's going to happen, you know, with the progression of the disease. So that is really important, to sort of link people with someone that's going to be able to give them a bit of a hand.
So your number three is, who gets dementia and what causes it?
Mm.
So is this predominantly an ageing disease?
It is, in regards to one of the risk factors of developing dementia is getting older. So as we age, our likelihood of developing a dementia increases. So whilst there are younger people who are diagnosed with dementia, we call them younger onset dementia, and that can be any age. We've had some of our youngest clients have been in their 30s.
Oh, wow.
And those people probably had other underlying health issues. So one of the people that I'm thinking of had Down syndrome. So those people are more likely to develop a dementia. I guess the thing about dementia is it's non-discriminatory. Anyone can get it.
So obviously, you know, in the community, dementia is a word tossed around a lot, and you see a lot of things, you know, take fish oil to ward off dementia.
Mm.
We've mentioned crossword, Sudoku, learn a language, take up an instrument. Like, what's the actual science behind all of this stuff?
There isn't a lot of science behind all of that. And I think it's probably a lot of it's people clutching onto whatever they think is going to work. There is very little evidence that any of that stuff will make a difference, but there is a big placebo effect. You know, if you take fish oil and you think it's going to maintain your cognition, then, you know, there's a lot of evidence that says keep doing that. Basically, there's no actual research that can back that. And there's very little, because I think there's no cure, and there's scrappling to sort of try and do research about medications to treat the disease. Anything that, because there's a drug that was released in the US just recently that they've withdrawn, and it was something like $56,000 per month for the people to take this medication, and they've just found that it, you know, actually has no benefit whatsoever in treating Alzheimer's disease. So I can see why people do find, you know, clutch onto things. There's no evidence really, or very little evidence that, you know, any of those things would work.
And is there a genetic component? Like, is it, you know, if you've got four grandparents and two of them have dementia, does that increase your chances, or? We don't know.
No, there is. It doesn't actually increase your chances. There's one type of Alzheimer's disease which is familial, and you would probably know about that if it was in your family, and you probably have had a test. But it's a lot of it's lifestyle too. Like the people who develop vascular dementia often have quite a vascular profile. So they often have high blood pressure, high cholesterol, perhaps not treated so well, might have type 2 diabetes. So those people can be more prone to developing vascular dementia because of the damage in their vessels, basically. And then other people, but it doesn't necessarily mean that if your father had vascular dementia, you're going to get it. But if you've taken on his lifestyle, you know, maybe he drinks a lot or he doesn't look after himself, doesn't eat well, you know, healthy heart and healthy brain are the same. So it's all about that Mediterranean diet, you know, not drinking more than one glass of alcohol for women and two for men a day and having a couple of alcohol-free days, you know, all of those things add up. So whilst there isn't any sort of prevalence, there is potential.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm. And so what you're saying is that you know, taking fish oil and eating well, there are definite lifestyle factors that may cause risk factors.
Definitely.
And that also, I guess, coming back to that cognitive reserve, that if you're engaged, you're older and you're social and you are keeping your brain active by reading and going to trivia nights and doing your Sudoku, that keeps building your cognitive reserve, which is potentially helpful.
But
there is no way that anyone can say this is genetic or this is preventative.
That's correct, yeah.
All right, now I have no idea what this next one is, so I'm genuinely asking this question. Your number four is, what is BPSD and validation? And I've never heard of either of those terms in relation to dementia.
Well, that's good. That means we're learning something. BPSD is behavioural and psychological symptoms of dementia. So we get quite focused on behaviours, especially when we've got somebody who's in our busy hospital ward, they're agitated, they're wandering around the unit, they're not happy, they won't have a shower, they're refusing their meds. So there's this term BPSD, and it used to be called years ago, it would be challenging behaviours, difficult behaviours, that sort of thing. Now people living with dementia would like it to be referred to as responsive behaviours. So just in the title there we see that it's the person reacting or responding to either their environment or something that's happening within them. So when we, it's high number of people who have dementia have BPSD. So, you know, a high 50s to 90% of everyone that develops dementia can develop BPSD throughout their journey. And the psychological symptoms, so, you know, we've got anxiety, depression, psychosis, and the behavioural symptoms present as aggression, apathy, agitation, disinhibited behaviours, wandering, nocturnal disruption, and vocally disruptive behaviours. So it's often that the person living with dementia can't express what they're feeling. So when you or I are anxious, we'll say, oh God, I feel really anxious. You know, I need to do whatever it is that I do that helps me deal with that. If you can't verbalize what's going on, or you can't actually recognize what's going on, then it will come out as a behavior. So say, for example, I'm in a busy ward and this nurse comes up to me and she says, okay, let's go and have a shower. And you don't want to have a shower for all of the reasons that nobody else wants to shower with anyone else. It's such an intimate act, but we are expected to just get our kid off and get in the shower with some random person we've never met. And you say no. And then they say, no, you've got to have a shower. No, I don't want to. I had one yesterday. So this is the behaviour that we see often with people in a, you know, in a busy hospital ward. So instead of saying, you know, most of the time nurses would probably say, okay, no problem, don't have a shower. But it's just the tip of the iceberg. That could just be one thing that they're refusing. The other thing that happens, especially in aged care facilities, is around sort of that changeover of shift time, sort of 2:30, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. A lot of nurses, you know, sort of say, bye, see you tomorrow, you know, I'm going. And you might have somebody who has been feeling quite anxious all day. They don't really know where they are. They don't know what's happening. They don't recognize anybody. And they think, oh, I need to go too. I need to go and get my kids from school. I need to cook dinner for my family. So then they'll be trying to exit seek. You know, they want to get out of the place as well. And that's considered a behavior because they're agitated and, you know, they can even become aggressive if somebody tries to stop them. So it's this this behavior as they – and we don't even really like the term behavior because it's – it's sort of it gives the connotation that somebody's doing it on purpose.
Purpose, yeah.
It's more an action.
It is.
That we interpret the intent behind.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. So that person isn't just being difficult. They didn't wake up in the morning and go, I'm going to make your life really difficult today and just, you know, try and be as annoying as possible. That's not their intention at all, no.
And so I guess what BPSD is, you're describing – I guess for all of us to learn that this isn't someone with dementia doing something. Mm-mm, mm-mm. There's almost a compulsion because they can't express it and they may not know. It's just like I've got to go too. Surely I've got to be somewhere. I don't recognize anyone here, so therefore I need to go somewhere that feels safe.
Yes.
It must be quite terrifying.
It would be.
To every day wake up and not recognize your surroundings or not know where you are or if you know, your last memory is something that was 40 years ago, then to say, wow, you know, I'm late for work. I'm late for school. I can't find my children. Where's the dog?
Like, yes. Yeah.
You'd almost have those restless legs out you
all
go, just searching.
Yeah. Yeah. It would be, just be so distressing. Yeah, exactly.
I think considering it as a symptom profile, I don't want us to just gloss over this and not consider the useful application of thinking like this as nurses working clinically. And I know we're going to get into that in a sec. Considering this as a symptom profile, that people carry a similar symptom profile if they're stable or even gradually declining in their cognitive function, those symptoms can be managed and like diminished by environment, by all of their normal things, and then disrupted significantly when they come into hospital.
Definitely.
So I think in experience that's really, really important to consider what and get that collateral information from either the care team, if they're in residential aged care, if they're still at home, from their family, about what's their normal BPSD profile and how do they manage that? Because it can be, you hear it so often, oh, they've got dementia. So everything, every disruptive action is normalized away. Mm. Every alteration on sleep, everything else can be very easily normalized away, where they can often have an acute delirium imposed on their dementia and are going to potentially not even be able to go back to the quality of life they had before their acute illness that they're in hospital for.
Yeah, very true. Yeah. It's very true.
So we've covered BPSD, so what's validation?
Okay, so I think one of the big things that we can do as nurses, and I've talked a little bit about anxiety. So often the big trigger for people is anxiety. So the first step it's sort of like a three-step process. The first step is acknowledging. So if you've got somebody who is in her 80s, she wants to go home and get the kids from school, the last thing you want to say is, how old are you? How old would your children be? They're not at school anymore. So what we want to do is we want to validate her. So we want to say, you seem really upset. I would be upset too if I couldn't find my kids. So it's about acknowledging her feelings. And then we want to offer her some help, you know, so can I help you to find where you need to be? And then the third part is really redirection or distraction. So how about we come and go and have a cup of tea, and you can, you know, maybe she's got some photos of her family, or she might have some things in her environment that you could start a conversation about. Maybe she's got a photo of somebody on her bedside table. Oh, who's this? You know, so it's really about those three parts, is acknowledging that she's feeling upset or anxious, offering her some help to try and solve that problem, and then redirecting her away from that train of thought, so to speak. So it's really simple, but it's really about, because it's often about, like you said before, if you are in an environment where you don't recognize anyone and you don't feel safe, the first thing, our flight or fight will kick in. That's what we do. We're humans. We go back to our lizard brain.
That part of their brain is absolutely still going to work.
Exactly. Yeah. So we want to get out. If we feel unsafe, we want to get out. So if we've got somebody then saying, you seem really upset and I'm really sorry that you're not feeling good, can we work on trying to come up with a solution? The minute you connect with somebody on that level, they're immediately changed. They immediately don't feel so frightened, and yeah, you can sort of hopefully calm them down.
We were talking about it briefly before the podcast as well, and while that person may not remember you, it's astonishing how you can build up familiarity over time with people that with quite advanced dementia.
Definitely.
So sort of build a relationship.
Definitely.
Or familiarity that decreases the anxiety,
yes,
increases the attachment and the ease of diversion,
yeah,
despite them not actually necessarily encoding or remembering you.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And often people with dementia say, you know, they might not remember your name, but they'll remember how you made them feel.
Mm. So we've already started to talk about this, but your number five is, you know, what can bedside nurses do or anyone – what can they do to care for people who are living with dementia, recognising that, you know, lots of people, as we have an ageing population, lots of our listeners are going to have someone in their family who are going to be diagnosed or already have a diagnosis of dementia. So what can we do about it? So already I'm thinking, like, how important is routine and familiarity?
Very important. Yeah, really, really important. And unfortunately, when people come to hospital, that's just completely thrown out. We often say, you know, emergency departments are the worst place in the world for people with dementia. It's bad enough for you and I to go to a busy emergency department. It's like being in a foreign country where you don't speak the language. It's just frightening. And then add dementia on top of that. So routine is really important. And trying to sort of maintain their familiar routine. So finding out, you know, do they have a morning shower? Do they have an afternoon shower? Do they not shower? Do they just have a bit of a bird bath? Do they, you know, maybe once a week have a shower? So getting a bit of an idea of their routine. What type of food do they like? What's their favourite food? That's really important, especially if you've got somebody who's refusing to take medication. You know, if it's something that can be crushed and they love custard, excellent, give it to them in that. Finding out what their favourite drink is, so that if you've got somebody that's quite agitated and you know that you can say, do you want to go and have a cup of tea with me, that they're happy to do that, that sort of thing. Knowing your patient, so knowing, it's difficult, I guess, when we see them for a very short time to really get a good history about, you know, what sort of job they did or what their family situation is or what their likes and dislikes are, but it's really not that difficult. We think about the interactions that we have with our patients, and in 5 minutes, you know, you could find out where they're from, what they did as a job, if they've liked dogs or cats, just basic stuff. And it's really about a way to get in so that you can build rapport with that person, because if they're feeling really unsafe and unsure, if you say, oh, do you want to see a photo of my dog, and they love dogs, you're in. You are immediately in. They are your best friend because you and they're on the same page, you know, like, you know me, I must belong here, I don't feel so anxious. So that's, you know, knowing your patient is really, really important. Helping to orientate your patients. So every single interaction, hi, I'm Charlene, I'm your nurse, I'm looking after you today. If you need anything, you know, even if you say it 50 times, it doesn't matter. And orientating them to, you know, you're in hospital, you're having a procedure or whatever it is, you're just here to get some tests. trying to reassure them that you're here to look after them and you'll be back. And often, you know, we're obsessed about buzzers and, you know, having the buzzer. But if you can't remember how to use a buzzer, then it's a pointless exercise. So doing that rounding where you're, you know, often, you know, popping in to see your person outside of cares and just saying, hi, I'm here. Is there anything I can get you? It does seem, you know, a lot of nurses probably are listening, oh my God, I haven't got time to do any of that. But if it's that 5 minute, not even that, 2 minutes interaction versus you having to find your patient who's disappeared or looking around the whole hospital for them, then it's definitely time well spent.
Yeah. Or dealing with them after they've had a fall and
injury as well.
Mm. Or becoming aggressive.
Yes, yes. So that's the last thing we want to do.
I guess one of the things that I'm really taking away from this is that it's really important to remember that you can have relationships with someone who has dementia.
Definitely.
Like a diagnosis of dementia is not the end of a relationship, even if they can't remember you, they don't know who you are. So if I've got a grandparent with dementia, the fact that I come twice a week, I always bring Tim Tams, I always bring the crossword, and I talk to you about the rugby league, then they can still look forward to that, have a sense of familiarity, even though they've got no clue that I'm actually their grandchild.
That's exactly right, yeah. And I think we do get a little bit obsessed about, you know, people not remembering you, or I've told that patient my name and they can't remember that I'm their nurse. Who cares? Like at the end of the day, you just want to help them to have a good experience, really. We want to get them to a point where they can be discharged. So it's kind of like getting through it in a way. That reminiscence is really important. So talking about things that they remember, not what you remember.
Yeah.
Trying to get into their reality, you know, that's really, really important. So if somebody is saying, you know, like, for example, I have to go and get my kids from school, you know, talking about you know, how many children, they might not remember how many children they had, but try and ask questions that have yes, no answers, or if you know they had children, how many they had, and you could say, you know, I really enjoyed making school lunches for my kids. Did you like that? And, you know, just
are you a baker?
Yes.
You know, it's so important to get kids to eat well, and what sort of things would you pack?
Yeah.
Just things that actually they can respond
can relate to.
And then that makes them feel, I imagine, a sense of control, which can actually calm their behaviour.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And I think too, because we are so, you know, there's lots of, we hear a lot about, you know, not accepting aggression as nurses, you know, like we don't tolerate people being aggressive to us and all that sort of stuff. So sometimes I think there is the immediate response to say, no, that's not okay. You can't say that to me. But, you know, like if you've got somebody that's swearing at you, words don't really hurt in that instance. So you just ignore it. Just ignore that they're maybe swearing at you. It might be just their natural language, or it could be just that it's easier for them to swear at you than it is to think about the actual words anymore, and they can't sort of, you know, make those sentences. Or if somebody, you know, goes to hit you, instead of sort of reacting, then just step back and just say, is everything okay? Because you seem really angry. Can I help you? Instead of going, don't hit me, that's not okay, then we just step back a little bit and say, you seem really unhappy, can I help you?
Yeah.
So just changing the focus on how we react to things is really important as well.
So using the validation techniques around all of those things.
Yes.
So invalidation, you're getting aggressive to me, and invalidation, you're raising your voice and I say, Charlene, you seem really upset. Mm. Is there something I can help with you with? Is there something that's bothering you? If they're like, I've got to get out, I've got to get my child to school. Well, that would be very stressful. I always feel so stressed if I'm running late to get kids from school. Mm. You know, like, let's go and sit down and, you know, like, I know you love chocolate milk and I've got some over here. Let's go and sit down over here and then work out what we're going to do together next.
Yep.
Something like that to just try and help de-escalate
Definitely.
It. Yeah. Yep. Okay.
And this takes practice.
Oh, like, definitely. It doesn't come naturally to everyone. Yeah,
none of us want to make out that this is an easy thing.
Not
to
at
do
all.
Because you're hijacking your natural protective instinct, mechanism.
Yes.
Your amygdala's going,
that's it. Yeah. Alarm. Yeah. Get out.
But so, one of the key tips that I would definitely say as well is support your colleagues that are looking after patients with dementia or delirium.
Mm.
in a setting that isn't geared to it. So like actually make sure they're okay, support them, take a 10-minute longer break to make sure you've kind of refueled your own, filled your own bucket enough to go back in and have maybe that extra 2-second pause before you react.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely, yeah, that's very important. And I think too, because often the person with dementia, often they'll have a special, they have an AIN special, and they, as this is in, I can only speak from Redlands Hospital, and often it's, you can see the faces on all the other staff, they're like, thank God she's looking after them because they're a handful. But also remembering that we're a team, you know, we all have to work together and, definitely helping each other out and supporting.
It can be actually also coaching the AIN that is doing that sitter shift. I hate hearing it that, but there are some that will literally just watch rather than proactively engage. Yeah. So a lot of it, again, as our role as registered nurses, is to guide and delegate and coach those under our
junior
delegation
staff, definitely.
With those patients.
For sure. And that's a big thing that I actually forgot to say about is boredom is a huge trigger for agitation. So if you've got somebody, you know, and activity isn't necessarily just, you know, winding wool or sorting out playing cards or something. Everything's an activity. So having a shower is an activity. Make it fun, you know, talk about subjects that the person's interested in. Have some nice music playing if you know that it's a real issue for them being comfortable in the shower. Think about everything you do. The meal, you know, like making the meal sort of enjoyable. And this is for people who've got a special. You know, I'm not saying that every registered nurse has time to spend, but It makes their life meaningful if they've got activity. Yeah. So when people are bored, then they really find their own fun.
I mean, I've had patients that have loved helping clean.
Yeah,
and tidy,
definitely.
Like giving them
fold,
a giving them
towels,
a wipe,
exactly.
Folding towels.
Yeah.
Like it's finding out what they tap into and
definitely.
Actually just giving opportunities to do it.
Yeah.
Had one older, 96-year-old lady who would can't just end up in the tea room with us and give people hand massages with the cream, and that settled her so much, so much. So she'd be sitting in there eating cake with one hand and hand massaging
I love
hand
it.
With
that's
the
awesome.
MicroShield cream with the other. Yeah.
And that's a lovely interaction for the staff as
it
well.
It is.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
My hands were never
But this is the thing, you know, like we've got people who are active all their lives. They work really hard. They have families. They have, you know, busy jobs. And all of a sudden it's like, nope, you're retired now. You can just sit and do nothing every single day for the rest of your life. Like,
Man, no I would be agitated if that was
definitely.
Me. Imagine if it was me.
You'd be well and truly sedated.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so this has been so interesting. I'm going to try and wrap this up in a succinct way. So number one is, what is dementia? And essentially what I've heard is it's an umbrella term for a progressive disease that impacts your brain and will affect the way that you remember, think and learn and problem solve. And that Alzheimer's is just one type of dementia. There's probably 100+ types of things that fit under the umbrella of dementia. Number two is, what are the signs, symptoms and diagnosis? So some of the signs and symptoms are memory loss, problem solving issues, you can't complete tasks, there's confusion around time, space, depth, perception, your judgment is affected, and the way that, you know, we lose the ability to problem solve, you know, what the memory that we've lost, and that diagnosis can be quite a lengthy process, and that we're trying to, I think Jesse used the term, it's a stepwise exclusion. So we're looking at the organic, the psychological, the functional, then we might go to investigations. But unfortunately with dementia, there's no cure and then there's no treatment. It's really about symptom management. Number three, who gets dementia and what causes it? And the biggest risk factor for dementia is age. However, you know, we have to think about lifestyle factors, and you mentioned, you know, vascular could be one of those if you've got high blood pressure, high cholesterol. So there's nothing really to prevent it. However, what we know is people who engage in a healthy diet, you know, moderate amount of exercise, they stay very sociable and engaged, it does help.
Definitely.
Longer term. However, there are people who can present with dementia as very young and that may have comorbidities associated to it. It's non-discriminatory. Mm-hmm. Number four, what is BPSD and validation? And BPSD is behavioral and psychological symptoms of dementia. And I guess Jesse used the word actions. It's what we're seeing as in response to people's depression, anxiety, confusion. And the validation is about how we can connect with someone. And I think this is a really important point, that dementia is not the end of relationships. Mm-mm. So validation is when someone, particularly if you're noticing them becoming agitated, distressed, anxious, validation is a three-step process where number one, we acknowledge that the person is having an emotional reaction. Mm. So that might be, you know, Bill, you seem really upset, or Bill, I'm concerned that you look really anxious over there. Mm. Number two is, can I help? Mm. So we're saying, Bill, I've noticed that you're looking upset. How can I help you? What can I do to look after you? And number three is redirection or distraction. So if Bill is like, I'm late for work, I've got to get to work, we approach them, we notice that he's upset about that. We say, it must be really stressful if you're feeling late for work. How can I help you? Now, I know that you really love chocolate biscuits and I've got one over here. Let's sit down and see if we can't work it out together, because that it's that relationship and familiarity which might help de-escalate the anxiety or the aggression, and hopefully, and this is a skill that we all have to work on.
Definitely.
And last but not least, coming back to the whole relationship being important for the bedside nurse. So we have to remember that if we've got any element of dementia, that any change in routine, change in environment can really escalate all of our symptoms. And so coming into a noisy ward and a noisy emergency department can make, I guess, all those threat alarms go off for the person with dementia. And so what we want to do is try and find something that is familiar, a connection, build a relationship, keep introducing yourself, keep assuring Bill, you know, like, Bill, I'm not sure if you remembered, you've hurt your leg and you're in the Royal Brisbane Hospital and your family is on their way. So just constantly reassuring and, I guess, locating them to time and place, and then attaching that to something that is familiar to them, like your wife Betty is on her way and, you know, she said that you've got a puppy. Can you tell me about that? Or she said that you're the number one Broncos fan. Have you been watching the Broncos? You know, who's your favourite player? And if Bill tells you someone from 30 years ago, then go with that.
Excellent.
All right. I think that that's
you
a wrap.
A lot.
I did learn a lot. Charlene, thanks for coming and explaining to us about dementia today. But I think also thank you for really highlighting the importance of having a relationship, and that dementia is not necessarily the end of someone's life immediately, all their relationships, and just sharing your passion with us today. So thanks for joining us on Five Things.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
The Royal Brisbane and Women's Hospital Five Things Nursing Podcast acknowledges the Turrbal and Yuggera as the First Nations owners of the lands we now tread. We pay respect to their elders, laws, customs, and creation spirits. We recognise that these lands have always been places of healing, teaching, and learning. We also wish to acknowledge the First Nations people of the lands of our global community, and encourage our listeners to seek out, listen, and learn from the knowledge held in your shared space. As well as all major podcast outlets, you can find us at fivethingsnursing.podbean.com. Please also subscribe and give us a rating on your listening platform of choice. This helps others find the podcast. And finally, if you'd like to connect with Liz or myself on Twitter, we can be found at LizCrow2, and for me, it's inject_orange. We would absolutely love to hear your thoughts, ideas, or feedback. Thanks for listening to Five Things.